Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special Blogger News on the Radio show. I'm a news junkie, and I've been following the antics of O.J. Simpson for well over a decade. I believe it's 13 years. The original 1995 criminal trial was nothing short of a travesty of the justice system in my simple mind. But, of course, you can also view it as living proof that if you have enough money, you can buy yourself the desired result. Although, as I recall, he wasn't very willing to actually pay the eventual bill, and that was to his own lawyers. The civil trial took a different turn. He was found resoundingly guilty of the murders of his ex-wife, Nicole, and a young man, Ron Goldman. O.J. has skated the law for years, but finally some satisfaction has been achieved. O.J. sits in jail, and the years are against him. He is 61 years old, and he has to deal with a sentence that is somewhere between 9 and 33 years. Some might well say this is a death sentence. So, let's get to the meat and potato. From Virginia, we have Mondo, the force behind deathby1000papercuts.com, and his trusty cohort, Jen. And we have our very, very special guest, Peter Haven. Peter is one of the attorneys representing the Goldman family, and he is tasked with trying to pry the well over $33 million owed to the Goldman family by O.J. Welcome, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, Simon. Okay.
Before I unleash the dogs of war, Peter, how did you get involved with this case?
Well, I am practicing in Los Angeles, and I have been here since I went to law school at UCLA starting in 1991, graduated in 94, and then I worked at a law firm in downtown Los Angeles for many years. So I was basically a local Los Angeles attorney. And a couple of years ago, it was in the summer, I think, of 2006, I was approached by individuals who were representing Frederick Goldman in an attempt to try to once again explore new ways of attempting to satisfy or partially satisfy this civil judgment. And at the time, the concept was explored of trying to take hold of O.J. Simpson's right of publicity. Every individual has a right of publicity, and in theory, it can be an attachable monetary property right. And so I was asked to serve as local counsel over 2 years ago on an attempt to file a motion in the Santa Monica Superior Court to try to recover his right of publicity. It was a novel motion, and it probably had little likelihood of success at the outset, but you know, we need to explore new ways to try and satisfy a judgment that was otherwise uncollectible. And it was just as this process ended, as soon as it was apparent that we were going to lose our motion, literally on the final day that they could make that announcement and not have us move for reconsideration, they announced that, in fact, he had already written a book called If I Did It, which was his hypothetical account of how and why he committed the murders. And once that asset was revealed, then our entire team focused on pursuing that asset, and that obviously just led to a whole chain of events, which basically brings us up to where we are today.
Okay, now, I understand that it was a fairly active day in court yesterday. You know, he's cooling his heels at the expense of the government. What happened yesterday?
Well, a couple of things happened.
Oh, sorry, not yesterday, Friday.
That's all right. A couple of things happened on Friday. First of all, we appeared Friday morning at the Santa Monica Superior Court because right after, or as the Vegas proceeding criminal proceeding was drawing to an end. One of our lawyers has been in very close contact throughout that entire time period, my partner on the civil judgment collection side, David Cook. And David Cook had developed a strong rapport with the Vegas authorities, including some of the detectives and investigators who worked with the Las Vegas District Attorney's Office. And one of these investigators notified David that while he was in seclusion with one of the quote-unquote alleged victims of the Vegas break-in, a guy by the name of Alfred Beardsley, who himself is a convict and who violated his parole by being in Vegas. And so when Beardsley violated his parole, he was basically remanded to custody. And while he was in the process of being transported back and forth, he had a conversation with this investigator with the Vegas District Attorney's Office, an investigator by the name of Bill Faulkner, and he told Faulkner in the car, Faulkner was basically saying, you know, why did you change your testimony, Mr. Beardsley? And Beardsley told investigator Faulkner that he changed his testimony because Simpson had offered him or given to him a Hall of Fame ring to try to coerce different testimony from Beardsley. As some people may recall, Beardsley was the one who made the 911 call saying that someone just robbed him at gunpoint, and then suddenly, dramatically, very shortly thereafter, Beardsley's whole tune changed. Well, we were in court on Friday because we asked Beardsley to testify a week ago Friday as to whether or not he had the ring, and Beardsley refused to testify. He took the Fifth Amendment. Investigator Faulkner testified as to what Beardsley told him, and then we hauled Beardsley back into court Friday to produce the ring, as he was supposed to have done, and then he waived his Fifth Amendment, and he testified at great length about how Faulkner had lied, allegedly, and this was all not true. So under the circumstances, we convened with the judge, and we decided that the best course of action was to get what we call an evergreen order, which means that if Beardsley ever comes into possession of this Hall of Fame ring, he's under an order to turn it over to us. So the attempt to get this ring, which Beardsley had told Faulkner was worth about $200,000, at present, that's sort of fruitless. That was one development on Friday. Also, at the exact same time, Judge Glass, who was the Las Vegas judge presiding over the criminal trials, she was dealing with the quote-unquote evidence of the Vegas proceeding. Now, the material evidence that was seized in the Vegas proceeding included a great deal of memorabilia, which was the subject of this whole gathering in Vegas. And we had previously had an order from our Santa Monica Superior Court indicating that if any of those items were ever found or determined to be Simpson's property, then we had a claim to it in partial satisfaction of our judgment. So Judge Glass on Friday ruled that the whole lot of memorabilia would be basically shipped off here to California, and now it's going to become, in a sense, property of the Superior Court here. We're going to litigate different claims of potential ownership here, including claims by Beardsley and others. And then at some point we suspect there'll be a determination that some of this property we will be able to auction off in partial satisfaction of our judgment. So apologize for the long-winded response, but those are the two developments that unfolded Friday.
Well, I have a question, Peter, about that, about Beardsley.
Mm-hmm.
If it can be proved that he changed testimony, is there some sort of perjury charge as far as changing your
evidence? Well, he's definitely liable for perjury, he faces potential perjury charges. He clearly changed his testimony. He initially took the Fifth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Perjury is a charge that's easy to claim and very, very hard to prove. You have
right.
to prove that he lied.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be obvious to many people that he lied, and I'm in my own heart of hearts, I feel certain that he did. The perjury, if any was materially committed, occurred in Vegas in connection with his altered testimony in the Vegas criminal proceedings.
That's what
so if anyone was going to charge him for perjury, it would probably be the Vegas people. I suspect, I can't speak for them, but I suspect, you know, considering everything else that they've done, they're really not interested in pursuing that, and I suspect that they won't.
Okay.
I have Peter, how much was the total judgment that O.J., that Goldman's won against O.J. What was their
Initially three judgments, and there were three judgments because there were two families. Each of them was entitled to a wrongful death action. As to Ron Goldman, there were essentially two actions that were brought. Frederick Goldman brought a lawsuit, but also Fred's ex-wife, Ron's biological mother, brought a lawsuit, and her name is Sharon Rufo. At the end of the day, $33 million was awarded. $19 or $20 million was awarded to the Goldmans, meaning Fred and Sharon, and
okay.
I think $14 million was awarded to the Browns. As to the Goldman portion, there was essentially an agreement that $19 million of it would be allocated to Fred, about $1 million of it would be allocated to Sharon. So the short answer to your question is Fred's initial judgment was $19,725,100, I believe, if memory serves.
Okay.
Under,
okay.
Under California law, that grows at 10% per year, so it has more than doubled now.
Oh, okay. Now, how much do you figure there might be? Where are you just ballparking the amount that maybe the memorabilia might bring?
No idea. Not much. You know, I don't know how much this stuff fetches. I was once told, I had a conversation over the telephone a couple of years ago with Mike Gilbert. Mike Gilbert is the former O.J. Simpson business manager who dealt with him closely during the criminal trial and for many years before and after that. And he was telling me, you know, Gilbert and Simpson have since had a major falling out, and they now, you know, appear to be at odds with one another. But Gilbert was deep in Simpson's camp at this point. And Gilbert would tell me that if Simpson showed up and signed a photograph, that would be worth about $500. If he signed a football, that could be worth about $1,000. But it's difficult to tell who would want to pay these kind of monies now. It's also not clear whether or not who's selling the item will change its value. You know, if we're selling it on behalf of Frederick Goldman, we're not clear how that's going to affect the value. So it's very difficult to say. I would guess maybe $5,000 or $10,000, you know, the whole lot. But
really?
I'd have to really sit down and inventory all of it.
Oh, okay.
Well, if I go back to the right to publish, I mentioned earlier about there's a new Inquirer story out that O.J. Simpson's talking about writing a tell-all memoir that says that he did it. And then he's shopping it around to publishers for cash. If the cash is paid to an offshore account, and one of the people mentioned in the Inquirer story is Mike Gilbert.
Yeah, well, is Gilbert the one who supposedly leaked this information? Or?
No, they mentioned Gilbert. It said that he had already confessed to the murders to Al Cowlings and to Mike Gilbert. That was how Gilbert was mentioned. But let's go back to the right to publish, because I assume that as a convicted felon, I'm not sure. What's the law in Nevada as far as convicted felons and being able to publish anything that's to do with a crime? But this is a separate crime he was found innocent of. So does he have the right to publish any account he wants as far as the murders?
Well, just in listening to you talk it through, you've done a good job of analyzing all the issues just by talking about them. And, you know, you started off with what crime was he convicted for and what crime is he going to talk about. And technically speaking, as far as the crime that he was charged with in L.A., leaving aside the civil proceeding, he was never convicted of that crime. The short answer to your question is yes, he can write a book. There are various laws which talk about what you can do as far as writing about your crimes and profiting from them. But for the most part, everyone has a First Amendment right. And if he wants to write a book, he can write a book. How he's going to try and structure the transaction to avoid the reach of people like me and my partner David Cook will remain to be seen. But I do want to thank you, because I was not aware of this information at all. And contrary to popular belief, I don't completely discredit anything that the National Enquirer says, because when we were pursuing his right of publicity, it was the Enquirer that first leaked the story that he was going to write a book called If I Did It. And we.
It's gonna be didn't. Now. I did it.
Now I did it. Yeah. So I suspect he's gonna try to do something like that, and I'm gonna consult with my partner, and we're gonna focus on that. I don't know how much of it we're gonna be able to do. It doesn't surprise me at all, because another one of the theories that emerged as I was going through this process the last 2 years, he's searching for money. There's no doubt about that. But he's also searching for something else. He really wants, in my opinion, to have his own stage and tell his own story and get it. I don't know if getting it off his chest is really the right way to say it. I think he really wants to be at center stage again, and he's tired of seeing everyone else take his celebrity status, or whatever you want to call it, away from him. And I really believe that that's why he wrote If I Did It.
Oh,
I really
think you're right on the money.
I totally
agree with you.
I think that's why he wanted the hotel break-in televised.
Yeah.
Oh, do tell us that story. I mean, this, to me, stretches my imagination to its limits.
Well, it's pretty fascinating. While the Vegas criminal proceedings, after he was arrested and charged, but before the trial actually began, we received a newspaper report. I have a copy of it somewhere. But essentially, 3 weeks before the break-in occurred, Thomas Riccio, who was basically OJ's partner in this hotel room incident, Riccio contacted the FBI on behalf of Simpson and indicated that they wanted to alert the FBI that they were going to do this, and that they had hoped the FBI would sort of cooperate with them and engage in this joint sting operation together, as they called it, and that it would be televised. OJ was really, in my opinion, seeking, again, what I call a stage. And
what one wonders if he was going for pay-per-view.
He really thought he was going to be portrayed, in my opinion, as some sort of, a good guy, for lack of a better phrase.
Is that why he made that statement that was so bizarre about when he was arrested, something about he was acting as part of an FBI sting?
When he was arrested, if you recall the mugshot and you recall some of the video of him in his handcuffs, you know, he was kind of smiling. He was happy. Mm-hmm. He really thought, I think, that, you know, this was a good thing and that he was doing a sting operation and he was a good guy. He may still believe that. I don't know. But the point is he had been formulating this plan for some time, which meant that some of the statements he made to the judge during his sentencing hearing recently were pretty surprising, like saying, you know, I didn't plan on any of this until the weekend I got here, which was a pretty shocking statement, given that it's basically a matter of record that the FBI knew about this thing 3 weeks in advance.
I'm not a lawyer, but I do have a question, and I'm sure it's one that you've heard before. And it's probably a question many lay people want to ask. So you have this very large judgment that comes from a California court.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Simpson relocates himself to Florida, which effectively he's escaped the tentacles of the California system. But would it not have been possible to pursue him in the Florida court system?
In theory, it's possible. In reality, it's not, for one big reason. The primary asset that most people own, and the primary asset that judgment creditors and their attorneys look for, are homes. And he does own a home in Florida, and the reason he moved to Florida is that he could own a home there, because Florida has an extremely generous homestead exemption law. Homestead exemptions are laws that basically protect homeowners from foreclosing on their homes by anybody who has a debt against the homeowner. Most states have homestead exemption laws, but they're usually capped at a certain amount, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, or whatever, meaning if you foreclose, by statute, that the homeowner gets the amount of the statutory homestead exemption. In Florida, the homestead exemption is unlimited. which basically means that you can't foreclose on his home to collect a debt. That's the biggest reason why he moved to Florida, to take advantage of the homestead exemption laws there. So his primary asset is beyond our reach. His secondary asset is a series of pensions, which he basically created on his own, and that's another long story. But pensions, by law, are not attachable to satisfy judgment debt. And then the third form of income that he has is income that we've sort of known about for years, and that's cash under the table and cash side transactions that come whenever he goes to one of these autograph signing events or something. And it's just very difficult to get that money. For one thing, you have to know about it in advance. You have to be prepared for it. You have to get court orders. You've got to go out there physically. And that's a lot of time, energy, and expense. And, you know, we can't afford to be chasing potential duffel bags of cash that may or may not show up all over the country. So the practical reality is, in theory, he's still reachable. It's just that he has legal protections there that make any reach ineffective.
What about money? Any monies that he has in offshore accounts, are those untouchable too?
Well, they're very difficult to get at. If you want to go after an offshore account, the first thing you have to do is you have to find out where the account is. And it's very difficult to locate an offshore account. There's a reason they're offshore. Mm-hmm. If you call up a bank in, say, the Bahamas, and you say, listen, we want to know if you have an account under the name of Orenthal James Simpson, they're not going to tell you that. They don't do business by making it publicly known that they have accounts of people you may want to reach. So you say, well, let's just get a court and we'll order them to tell you. And the answer to that is, well, which court? You know, if I serve them a subpoena from California, the court that I issue it out in California, they can issue a subpoena and you can hand it to Bank of Grand Cayman, and they'll look at it and they'll say, okay, what do you want? And we'll say, tell us this. And they'll say, no. And I have no ability to call anyone in from Grand Cayman, the Bahamas, and make them testify and subject
them
to the power.
But you do know one of his best friends does investments offshore.
Well, I don't know if you're referring to Bruce Fromong or not. Fromong indicated that he did offshore investing in the past for O.J. The bottom line.
We did a story on when O.J.'s girlfriend supposedly fell and hit her head.
Yeah.
At a gas station.
Yeah.
Did you ever find out if that story held up or?
Well,
yeah, she was in intensive care for 10 days on hitting her head.
The interesting shoot was that we were contacted by a friend of OJ's who told us that we'd gotten certain parts of our story wrong, and I was like, this is a crank or whatever. But we looked him up, and the guy was on the internet is an offshore investor, and he said that he was a very good friend of OJ's. So I just thought that.
He said he flew O.J. back, the reason that we'd gotten something wrong with the story. He said, oh, I flew O.J. back from Florida that day, and I knew he didn't do it. But then he runs offshore investments.
Yeah, he has a
business.
Well,
I'd be very interested in finding out more information about it, and perhaps we could do something off the air. But the short answer to your question is it's very difficult to get those monies, assuming you can even find them. But I am interested in pursuing any kind of lead that anyone has. So I do think it would be helpful to talk afterwards, and I could get down your information, and maybe I could follow up on it.
I will certainly make sure everyone has everyone's emails. How about
thank
that?
You.
No problem.
That sounds good.
Okay, Peter, you've been involved with this case for over 2 years. It's been dragging on for 13 years. In reality, have you actually managed to snag any of OJ's money?
Well, during my watch over the last 2 years, we had actually the most successful attempt to get money in satisfaction of the judgment that I think has probably ever occurred since shortly after the initial judgment was entered. I believe once the initial judgment was entered, which was done by attorneys who tried the case, not by myself or my current partners, I think they were able to get some assets. I think there were some sales of properties. I don't really know all those particulars. There's some talk about a Heisman Trophy that was auctioned off or something. I don't know how much money was generated from that. My understanding is not much. But recently, when he wrote his book, If I Did It, that was a significant asset, and that was created outside of any protections that I talked about before. It wasn't a pension, and it wasn't a homestead exemption. So we could, in theory, chase that book or those rights, the rights to that book. And that's what we did, and that's what generated a lot of publicity over about a year or two, is we were pursuing, in a sense, the ownership of that, of the rights to that book. But we got it. It took a lot of legal fighting, a lot of ups and downs. But eventually we acquired the rights to that book, and then the Goldman family, after, you know, much difficulty and soul-searching, we essentially published that book again. It never made it onto the bookshelves before. It was ready to go, but it got stopped by public pressure. Then the Goldmans acquired it after about a good solid year of legal maneuvering, and then they repackaged it. The text of the book is the same. It has some chapters that have been added to it, including a chapter that I wrote about the whole process of acquiring it. But If I Did It, the Goldman family version, is out there in bookstores right now. It's in paperback form right now because we came.
Actually, I have two of them. I have both versions.
I have a few copies myself. But that generated income. It generated, I would venture to say, ultimately anywhere from about $100,000 to $200,000 that the Goldman family will recover at the end of the day, because there's a lot of people had to get paid from those mm-hmm. proceeds as well in order to even achieve that result.
That's not really money
out of his pocket, though. That's the sale of his property. He got paid $630,000 for that book initially, and he got to take that money and walk away with it.
In many ways, though, the Goldman victory was a very hollow one. And I know that Fred Goldman had a lot of sleepless nights over it. Yes, he won the rights to the book, but wasn't part of the gaining the rights basically forced him into publishing it?
Yes. I don't think there was ever pursuing the book rights would have meant nothing unless at the end of the day, you know, we knew we were going to have to basically turn around and publish this book because there would be no point in acquiring it and doing nothing with it. In order to really make it a complete act, we were going to have to publish it. And yes, that was a very difficult time for Fred and for Kim, and you know, we had a lot of conversations about that. When they first heard about the book, they reacted, you know, instantly. They reacted the way anybody in their position would have reacted, and they said, you know, it's a terrible book. We hope no one reads it. It's terrible. It's awful. These people should all be banned for writing it. And then, as ironic and crazy as this whole process is, you know, we looked at the book rights and we said, you know, we can get this book, and this is an asset that can satisfy the judgment, partially satisfy it. And then we had to turn and talk with them about, you know, this is what we were going to have to do, and this is going to be very difficult, but this is the right thing to do. And at the time, you know, we didn't know where it was going to lead, but I kept saying, you know, this is a legal remedy. All you have is a judgment. If you don't enforce the judgment, then the judgment doesn't exist. You might as well just give up and go home. You're either going to have to enforce it and do some difficult things, or you're just going to have to let it all go. And I really believe that when we took that book away from him, we ended up, you know, pushing him over the edge and doing what he did in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's very strange the way things work out, and all I can ever tell my clients is, look, I don't know where this is going to lead. I know this is going to be difficult, but I'm a lawyer. My job is to enforce and apply the law. You have a judgment. This is an asset. This is the law. All I can tell you is we either apply the law and enforce it and do this, or we just go home and do nothing. Choice is yours. And that's not a choice. They had no choice.
I see it as a positive thing that the Goldmans did.
Well, I think they had to do it, and I think it was a positive thing. And I'm proud that we were able to accomplish it. And I knew in my heart that it was going to drive Simpson nuts. I knew it.
Oh, yeah.
I just never thought it would turn into this. But lo and behold, by chasing this book, getting it, publishing it, sort of against him, I mean, he went into that Vegas hotel room on the exact same day that the book, our book, was hitting the bookstores, and the Goldmans were on television to talk about it. They were on national television on the Oprah show that day, which was the big launching platform. And that night, he goes into the hotel room, and I learn after the fact that he wants to televise it. For me, that spells it all out.
I want to ask you something. Has the Goldmans ever been afraid of Simpson? You know, because he's kind of nutty, really. Have they ever felt afraid of him, of anything he might, any kind of retribution? Because they've kept after him.
I've wondered that myself. I've never asked him that question, but I suspect the answer would be no. They are absolutely tenacious in their hatred of him.
I don't know if it's necessarily hatred. It's just that they've thwarted him, which has been a good thing. You know.
Well, they thwarted him finally, but I think you know, for more than a decade, I think they felt like they had almost no power over him at all, and it was only that book. That book was the only thing that gave them any power over him at all. He was completely beyond their reach. And
I was looking at the winning of the civil suit, which got pretty much O.J. Simpson was, you know, sort of convicted of the murder, but not in a criminal court, a civil case. That to me was something I don't think Simpson ever wanted to happen. Of course, it may not have affected him. The guy's.
You know, Kim used to say about that moment, is she remembers that right after the civil judgment was entered, according to what she understood, Simpson walked out down the street and got an ice cream cone.
The guy's a narcissist, you know. He just...
I don't think he felt like that judgment affected him. He certainly didn't act like it did, but it did. It did.
Yeah.
It did in the court of public appeal.
It affected the court of public opinion without a doubt.
I'll tell you something else too. It kind of made him go underground. He wasn't going to sign any big movie deals because you'd have just grabbed the money.
He definitely had to, you know, live underground to the extent that someone like him has to live underground. He still, nevertheless, had a really nice life in Miami. I mean, a really good life. His pensions were paying him. You know, when we recently checked, his pension money was about $300,000 or $400,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
He has a home that can't be taken from him. He has $300,000 or $400,000 a year income. He's in Miami. It's nice, not a bad place to live. He's got a nice, beautiful girlfriend. Looks a lot like Nicole, and apparently he might get angry with her sometimes. At least we know that from police records. He had a good life. He was probably frustrated by certain things, but. You know, he could have had a great life if he had just stayed out of trouble, but he couldn't. I don't think he could control himself.
I think the trail of trouble makes for a fascinating read all by itself. I mean, it was as if every year or so he would just have to have another skirmish.
You know, my theory about him is that I really believe there are very few people that I personally can think of that had all of the qualities, for lack of a better word, that he had. He really had a lot of qualities that made people want to like him, and want to put him on a pedestal, and really love him and cherish him. So much so that I think a lot of people refuse to accept certain beliefs or truths about him. But I think the other side of the equation is I think he kind of had a godlike view of himself. And it's not like he spun that completely out of his own imagination. I think the world, for a long period of time, you know, gave him whatever he wanted. And I think it's difficult for someone who believes that they're godlike to just accept a quote-unquote ordinary existence, even no matter how nice it is. And that certainly seems to be the way he behaved.
Yeah, and the Goldmans took a lot of that away from him because he could no longer produce movies or star in movies or act in film.
That's right.
Any of that money would be turned over to the Goldmans, so that was cut out of his life.
Any of that money would be turned over to the Goldmans, and also the public stigma was a problem. It's a really good point that you make because the Goldmans were the only people who were really enforcing justice against him. Mm-hmm. They were the only people that refused to just let it go. They were the only people who kept pressure on him, mm-hmm. even at times when it appeared that there was no hope of ever getting any justice at all. And mm-hmm. I think they gave up on any sense that there was going to ever be any real justice. I think they just knew that they were never going to let go of this issue. But mm-hmm. if it weren't for them, all these other issues would have just sort of died away.
Mm-hmm.
The Brown family really couldn't do very much, and they certainly weren't doing very much. It was really all the Golden family.
Well, before he killed Ron and Nicole, he had his own production company. And mm-hmm. I was discussing with Mondo that I don't know if many people remember this, but before the murders, he was involved in some sort of, was it a TV movie or a TV series? Where is he
TV doing, movie, yeah.
Where he was a frogman?
Yeah, mercenary.
Mercenary or something?
Yeah, I heard about that.
And he was taught to, and they had in the film where he slit somebody's throat or was shown how to, you know, slash somebody's throat, and that disappeared. I mean,
you know,
ever,
I do recall hearing about that. Do you remember the name of the production company?
OJ,
OJ Productions, was that it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to just ask. Has anybody looked into any of the properties that OJ Productions owns? Because I'm telling you, if you owned the rights to that TV movie, it disappeared and never aired after the murder.
A couple of comments. First of all, we did receive an order when we got on the case a couple of years ago. We went in, we got a court order basically giving us all of his movie and television money, which means that if any of his productions or shows air at any time, and if there's any royalty to be paid of any kind, then we get it. And it included any of his productions. So if that movie ever became, you know, if anyone ever sold it or syndicated it or whatever, I don't think anyone will, we would get. But the second thing is, and that's really the bigger issue, is he used companies like OJ Productions and other companies that he created to actually insulate himself against the civil judgment. He had plenty of time to do it. He basically, OJ Productions was one of the companies that he created a pension in. He funded it with his own money. He made himself an employee of OJ Productions, and then he retired. And then he got a pension from OJ Productions and other companies that he created. And that's part of how he was able to get $300,000 or $400,000 a year that we couldn't touch.
Well, I was just going to make the point that if the Goldmans hadn't initiated the actions against Simpson, he would have resumed his production companies and been making films and been making a lot more money. And
yes, he would have. If they hadn't continued to just basically dog him or make it clear they were never going to let him go, he would have been free to do whatever he wanted, wherever he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really the same thing with the book. If they hadn't pursued the book, the mm-hmm. book would have just eventually gone back to him, and he would have published it again.
Going back to OJ Productions, surely if there is this supposed movie skulking around, it would be a potentially quite useful item to have. I don't think you'd have any trouble in finding people to air it.
That's what I was going to bring up. Can you only attach what that company does? I mean, is there no way to get control and force those properties out?
Well, it's an interesting question. It really comes down to who owns those properties right now. He may have assigned the ownership rights away to other people years ago. If, in mm-hmm. fact, he is still the owner of that property right, or if it's owned by a company which is really nothing more than a fraudulent shell of him, then we can go after it. OJ Productions, Inc. was a legitimate company at one time.
Yeah. That was before the murders occurred.
Yeah, it was before the murders, and it probably has the ownership rights to that entity, and it's probably now a defunct corporation because he retired, and I don't think it did any more business.
But that would be, a potentially valuable property.
Well, then you'd have to ask yourself, just assuming we could overcome the legal challenges to it, and we could claim that it's really his property, and we disregard the corporate form, which is something we can do. It's not easy, but we can do it. then I guess the question is, how do we? We don't have the right to basically own that production. We have the right to acquire the rights to it for purposes of liquidating it, or what we call monetizing it.
Right.
So then that would raise the next question: how would we convert that motion picture into money? Because we can't really keep the picture. We can sell the picture, but we can't really keep it and own it.
And
oh,
it's rather,
Spike!
It's rather ghoulish. I mean, I don't know if anybody would even.
I think there would be.
Because
yeah,
I think there
would
be. I think there would be too. It's just a question of what kind of interest it would be and how would it work. But it's definitely something to think about, and I'm grateful for the information.
Well, didn't they rule that they couldn't introduce that film into the trial because it was prejudicial, or didn't?
I wouldn't
any...
be surprised if that was a ruling. You know, I didn't agree with all the rulings as far as evidence in the criminal trial, but that wouldn't surprise me if that was one of the rulings that was reached.
Well, I think, in my own opinion, the Goldmans have had quite a few victories over O.J. They, you know, they'll never get justice for the murder of their son, but they've, like I said, they've been a thorn in O.J.'s side ever since then, and I applaud them for what they've done.
Well, I thank you very much, and I'll pass that information on to them. I think they feel that they've accomplished something. You're right; it's never going to be a complete victory. It's never going to be complete justice, but they didn't just give up on it. They kept fighting, and I think they got a result that they earned. I mean, by pursuing that book, I really believe that they caused what he did in Vegas, and it sounds like he's still in the same train of thought. He's going to write some other book right now, and that's something I'm definitely going to start looking at more closely.
Yeah, well, he's the type of guy that, you know, it's never over till the fat lady sings. He's going to be...
No, you're right. With him, it's never over. There's something more coming down the pipeline in all of this. It's just, it's never going to quite go to rest. There's something more that'll happen. I just don't know what it is. It's very unpredictable.
And I'm sure he's probably appealing that conviction.
Yes, but what about the appeal process?
I give little or no likelihood chance of success on appeal. There's a couple of factors that are going to go up on appeal. As far as Simpson is concerned, his chief claim on appeal will be that there was some sort of systematic bias in the selection of jurors and that African-American jurors were prejudicially excluded. Good luck establishing that on appeal.
How ironic.
Well, I mean, that he's basically saying, look, I mean, we know my track record. If I'm in front of what I believe is the jury of African-American peers in L.A. in 1994, I think I prevail. Mm-hmm. If I'm in front of a Santa Monica jury 2 years later that is an all-white jury, I think I lose, and I think that everybody knows that. This is his theory. This is not what I'm saying. This is his theory.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
When you're trying to keep African-American jurors off the jury pool in Clark County, Nevada, you're doing that because you think that's your only way to win. It's not going to work on appeal. It won't
work. Is that his only appeal that he's got going?
There's another issue dealing with, handling of evidence and prejudicial biases. That he has even less chance of success because that's just pure speculation. One of his co-defendants, Clarence C.J. Stewart, is claiming prejudice on the grounds that he was not tried separately, and that has little likelihood of success on appeal, in my opinion, and that stands a better chance than the what we call the constitutional challenge.
Mm-hmm.
CJ is basically saying, look, I mean, you screwed me when you tried me with my co-conspirator. I had no chance of escaping his dark shadow.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a terrible argument to make on appeal. I give no chance of success.
We're down to the final minute here, and I would love to keep this show going for a long, long time more, but we do have to wrap it up. Peter, I want to really thank you for taking part, and as I mentioned earlier, I'll make sure that everyone involved gets in the email loop, and I wish you every success in your quest for justice.
Well, I want to thank you very much, and I want to thank everyone on the call for the helpful information they provided. I'm very grateful.
Okay, thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Simon.
Mondo and Jen, always a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks,
and for folks listening in, we're going to take a 15-minute break, and then we're going to be attacking the Kaylee Anthony story, and there's a lot to talk about this week.
Okay,
goodbye.
Good luck, Peter.
Good luck.
Thank you both
bye-bye.
Very much. I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.